This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldone. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 220 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
This week's episode is brought to you by Brooklinen. Buying great sheets is an easy way to upgrade your life. The right sheets can make or break a good night's sleep and help you feel better and more well-rested every day.
We love Brooklinen here at the Outlander podcast. Brooklinen is the fastest growing bedding brand in the world because people love these products. Their sheets have over 12,000 five-star reviews.
I feel bad.
You feel bad.
I haven't put in a review yet.
Oh, well then we got to get moving. The reason there are so many reviews, the reason people love their bedding is because this is luxury bedding underpriced.
I love my Brooklinen sheets. Try them. I know you'll love them too.
Brooklinen.com has an exclusive offer just for our listeners. Get $20 off and free shipping when you use promo code Outlander at Brooklinen.com.
In fact, Brooklinen is so confident that you'll love your new sheets that they offer a risk-free 60-night satisfaction guarantee and a lifetime warranty on all of their sheets and comforters. There's no reason not to give these sheets a try.
The only way to get $20 off and free shipping is to use promo code Outlander at Brooklinen.com. That's BROOKLINEN.com, promo code Outlander.
Brooklinen, these are the best sheets ever.
We are very happy to once again welcome Dr. Christine McKenzie to the Outlander podcast. Now, Christine was with us before to talk about all things Jacobite, and now she's returned to talk about Print Society. And that, of course, is a tie-in to our favorite printer, our favorite seditious printer of the 18th century in Scotland, A. Malcolm. Welcome, Christine McKenzie, and tell us a little bit more about yourself.
Thank you for inviting me back. It's an absolute pleasure to be back, particularly with such an important episode in the Outlander story. So it's a real privilege to be back. And my initial interest is obviously with the 17th century. I've gradually become interested in the Jacobites. I taught a course on the Jacobites at the University of Aberdeen for a couple of years, but I also have an interest in early modern print culture, early modern books in the Stuart era. So it's great for me to sort of discuss what I suggest is also one of my favourite topics, if you like. And what I'd like to do is introduce you to, or give you some flavour of what Edinburgh would have been like when Jamie or A. Malcolm was living there, but also the sort of life he would have had as a printer and what sort of things he would have printed, but also the importance of the printing press as well. So if this is okay with you, that's what I'd like to do today.
That sounds great. We can't wait to hear more about the world of A. Malcolm. So before we launch into more specifically into the business of printing in Edinburgh in the 18th century and the world of A. Malcolm, can you give us some indication of the wider historical importance of print in Europe?
Yes, indeed. The printing press was highly significant in changing Europe since its appearance in Europe. Around about 1439, printing press, the ink type printing press, appeared in Mans. In now what we would call Germany, but back then it was known as the Holy Roman Empire. And the press, or the invention of the press, is credited to a man called Johannes Gutenberg. In fact, the printing press for many years was known as the Gutenberg Press. So why is the emergence of the press in Europe so significant, and why am I bothering you with this context all the way back into the 15th century? The significance of the printing press is in the spread of ideas. With the invention of the printing press, ideas could be transmitted faster as multiple copies of the same book could be printed within the fraction of the time and the cost of writing ideas down on a parchment of vellum. Of course, in the medieval period, ideas were using ink. Some of them were embellished with colour, etc. But with the printing press, books could be printed with ink using a press, and multiple copies of the same book could be churned out a lot faster than it would be physically writing ideas down on parchment or vellum. Secondly, multiple copies of the same book could be bought by a multitude of people. And although literacy at this time was confined to the elites, those elites could transmit these ideas to the illiterate by talking about ideas in small groups or by preaching. So even if the population was largely illiterate, which it was back in this period, this early period around about 1439, ideas could be spread orally. People could read the books and then transmit these ideas. Thirdly, as well as this information revolution, as we now call it, it's one of these trendy academic terms, took off, many of the works previously printed in Latin and confined to the intellectual priests, intellectual elites like the priests and the church, could now be written down in the vernacular or native languages. So more people could get access to texts that were previously in Latin. So if they're written down in, obviously, in the native language, more people can understand them, therefore ideas spread. So, you know, texts were written in languages such as German, French and English, and they could be understood by a greater number of people. The printing press and its emergence at the 1500s in major European cities was instrumental in the beginnings of what we know as the Protestant Reformation. And it led to parts of Germany, England and Switzerland breaking from Rome and the papacy through the printing of the Bible. And this again shows the transmission of ideas, that the Bible was written in the vernacular, wasn't written in Latin, so it was no longer confined to priests saying mass, etc. Therefore, these new ideas and what were considered at the time radical ideas spread. And of course, with these emerging religious divisions in the 16th century, divisions between Catholics and Protestants emerged as people conformed to the new religions and some people stayed with the old religion. It led to serious and bloody conflicts in places like the Netherlands and France at the end of the 16th century. So what I'm trying to sort of get across here, although we're going further back than we need to, is that Europe had changed utterly as these ideas spread, and these ideas spread across social status, linguistic and geographical borders, because people would translate works into their own languages. The state was both threatened by this information revolution, so it developed censorship and licensing practices for printers to halt the spread of these dangerous ideas. But on the other hand, the state saw the power of propaganda and of the printing press, so it would use these ideas to promote its own very existence, to promote a favourable view of itself and what it was doing. So that is, although it's background, this background will come into play when we discuss, obviously, the world of Alexander Malcolm.
So how did the printing press develop in Scotland from the 1500s to the 1760s? What is the place of Edinburgh in these developments?
Edinburgh was the first place in Scotland to establish a printing press, and did so in 1508 when Scotland was still a Catholic country and still tied to Rome. However, compared to London from the 1500s to 1760s, the press's outputs were a trickle compared to the flood of books that flowed from the printing presses in London. London was one of the major information hubs during this period, along with Paris and Geneva and all these other places. By comparison, Edinburgh was very much a minor player in the book trade. But there are reasons why Edinburgh became the first place to establish a printing press in Scotland, and these threads carry through to the 18th century. Not only was it Scotland's capital city, but it was the seat of royal power and government, with the monarch visiting, as it would have been the case in the 18th century, or in earlier times would have been at Holyrood Palace or Edinburgh Castle. The Scottish Parliament also met here too, but it really was the presence of the law courts in Edinburgh and the foundation of Edinburgh University that really brought the printing press to Edinburgh and gave it a sustainable future. Much of the output in these years was tightly controlled by successive governments, and it was a mixture of state proclamations from the monarch, the printing of laws and statutes, religious work by Protestant ministers, particularly after the Scottish Reformation in the 1560s, and state-approved political treaties. Edinburgh was also close to the port of Leith, where books and ideas contained within them could be imported from the European continent. So you get books imported from Paris and Geneva, etc., into the port of Leith, which was just outside Edinburgh. Indeed, for the majority of this period, Scotland was primarily a net importer of books, rather than an exporter of books. Edinburgh continued to be the main printing press during this period, but several presses had been established between 1508 and 1766. And this is important to understand that obviously the printing world of Edinburgh is part of a larger Scottish structure. It is noticeable that between 1508 and 1638, all presses except for Stirling were established in university towns. So again, it's the universities keeping these presses alive: Edinburgh, St Andrews, Aberdeen and Glasgow. And these become permanent. They more or less stay in the same place for 150 years. Again, you've got the printing presses established at Leith in 1651, obviously because it's a major port. And then, of course, you've got a printing press established in 1638 in Glasgow. And this is partly political, but it's also partly to do with the fact that Glasgow is starting to become a port of shipping, and they look out towards the emerging colonies in the Americas. So you've got the printing presses being established in these towns. From 1685 to 1766, there is evidence of small homemade makeshift presses in the Campbell areas of the Highlands. Now, the Campbells were very loyal to the government, so it's not a surprise that they get, you know, you see non-permanent printing presses pop up. But by 1715, smaller Scottish cities such as Perth and Dumfries have a printing press. In fact, the establishment of a printing press at Perth directly plugs into the Jacobite rebellions, because it was due to the Jacobite rebellion in 1715 that the King's printer travelled to Perth. Obviously, what we mean by the King's printer is the Hanoverian government travelling to Perth and establishing a printing press. So it's all in reaction to the 1715 rebellion. By the 1750s and 1760s, there were presses in Dundee, Berwick-upon-Tweed and Falkirk, but the outputs were much smaller than Edinburgh. Edinburgh's smaller than London, but it's bigger than the other printing presses in Scotland.
What sort of society and circles would Alexander Malcolm have moved in 1766? What sort of books would he have been printing? And what, if any, is the significance of the time he's living in?
Alexander Malcolm or Jamie would have come in contact with multiple social circles in Edinburgh being a printer. First and foremost, he would have been part of a close-knit network of printers, publishers and booksellers. Everyone in the trade knew everyone else, either as competitors and or friends. This network was held together through the knowledge that they were all to be licensed and bound by codes and standards in the profession, and not to print libelous material, and also to obey laws on copyright. However, on the latter, Scottish printers did not always obey the rules if there were profits to be made, particularly if they could reprint material that was being published in London. If money was involved, they would quite happily transgress copyright laws. Secondly, the Edinburgh printing scene in the 1760s was quite isolated from the rest of Britain. So some printers took on the role of editors and businessmen, looking for works that would be profitable. So not only is Jamie a printer with a printing press, he's a businessman. He has to commission books, looking at the demand in the marketplace. And a good example and a very successful example of a printer in Edinburgh during the time was a man called William Schmelly, who began his career in the 1760s and went on to become Edinburgh's leading printer by the 1780s. He used to set up meetings with potential authors in local taverns and pubs around Edinburgh, and after a couple of drinks, invite them to spit works to his press. Unfortunately, editors don't do that now. I wish they still did. It would be fun to meet your editor in a pub, but sadly that tradition's long gone. But that's what he used to do. They set up meetings with authors in pubs, encouraged them to submit their works. But Smelly was also an editor. He also edited publications, and he became an editor of a publication called The Scots Magazine from 1759-6. And today, that magazine's still running. And it's one of Scotland's longest-running publications. Printers, so it had to be businessmen. They had to actively look to secure high-profile publishing contracts. This Smelly did par excellence, securing the printing of the first edition of the Encyclopaedia Britannica, which is, I don't know if many in the States would know, but it's a landmark publication in Britain. It was our first encyclopedia in Britain, and it's still being published again to this day. So it was very much a landmark publication. But also as well, he would publish works such as William Buchan's Domestic Medicine, which was popular in many households up and down Scotland, so he sold plenty of copies. He also joined forces with other printers in Edinburgh, and it's likely that, you know, Jamie would have done the same. That if there's a big contract to be made, some Edinburgh printers who were friends would band together and secure new contracts and from new authors. And with regards to Smelly, he joined forces with a printer called William Creech, and he befriended a new poet, probably in a pub, called Robert Burns. The Robert Burns. And he published his poems, which were called Poems Chiefly in a Scottish Dialect, in 1794. So it's a very close-knit community where everybody either competes with one another or works together. But also, a printer in Edinburgh would have come in direct contact with the authors, and this is quite important. Again, as I say, they're not just printers sitting behind a press doing nothing. They're coming in contact with the authors. So Alexander Malcolm would have associated himself with some very influential people. He would have met some very influential people and would have been part of their social circle. So the first sort of wider social circle he would have come in contact with would have been the Scottish lawyers. And this is because, obviously, the legal institutions in Scotland that were based in Edinburgh, like the Court of Session, etc., would have wanted the proclamations and laws printed, not just for distribution to the various courts around the land, but deposited in what we call the Advocate's Library. Now, an advocate is, I don't know what the equivalent would be in the States, but it's equivalent of a barrister in England. An advocate is sort of top of the profession. I don't know what you would call it in the States, but they were the top lawyers in the legal system, so he would have come in contact with these individuals. In addition, there were groups of lawyers who liked to discuss and write treatises on Scots law, its legal history and practice. Lawyers used to regularly use the presses in Edinburgh. As historian Stephen Brown has declared, lawyers and printers had formed a fraternity in Edinburgh. And we'll discuss the importance of that with regards to Jamie Fraser's position and, you know, obviously his past, because it's quite a clever move what he's done here to come in contact with these people. The second group of people he would come in contact with are the intellectuals. Importantly, when Jamie's in Edinburgh as a printer, it is the beginning of the Scottish Enlightenment. So this is when intellectual discovery and science began to challenge the old order. And Scottish Enlightenment, obviously, the fruits of the Scottish Enlightenment very soon became global. Its influence was truly international. So we're talking here a major intellectual movement that has affected the way we live our lives today. 10 years after, obviously, we see Jamie in Edinburgh. He's in Edinburgh in 1766. 10 years later, in 1776, Adam Smith, the Scottish philosopher, publishes his seminal work, The Wealth of Nations, which is behind much of capitalist thinking today, which is behind, you know, much of how our society works with money, etc. So that just gives you a flavour of the importance of the Scottish Enlightenment. Many scholars from Edinburgh University, by the time we get to 1766, have already published key works using the Edinburgh printing press, such as David Hume's History of Great Britain, and the Edinburgh Press's regularly published works of the Edinburgh Philosophical Society. So they have direct links with the top minds at the University of Edinburgh, direct links with the top minds in the Scottish Enlightenment, where they publish medical and surgical works, but also publish periodicals discussing political thought and current affairs, and this including a magazine called Spectator, which is still published today. So again, it's just to give you an idea of the sort of importance of what's coming out with the Scottish Enlightenment and the sort of era that Jamie Fraser is printing his works in. Also, printers at this time in Scotland began to print atlases and maps. So again, instead of drawing maps with ink and pen and, you know, colouring things in, something like that. I should use the technical terms, but I won't. They reproduced maps with the printing press, which was a lot faster and a lot easier and a lot quicker. Such was Edinburgh's reputation during this period that Benjamin Franklin visited Edinburgh twice, first in 1759 and secondly in 1771. The third sort of group of people that, as a printer, Jamie Fraser would have come in contact with are ministers, are members of the Church of Scotland who want Bibles to be printed. Despite the Enlightenment and the rise of science and secularism, they're obviously, you know, Scotland is still a religious society and Bibles were still being printed. So again, Jamie would have come in contact with ministers who wanted Bibles printed. Particularly during this period, which is interesting, Bibles were beginning to be produced in the Gaelic language for ministers who were obviously sent to the Highlands to propagate the Christian gospel. So, in this period, long-term contracts began to emerge for the printing of Bibles in the Gaelic language, and William Smellie was one of those that managed to obviously bag of these lucrative contracts for Gaelic Bibles. As I say, this reflects the ongoing missionary activities to promote gospel, I dare say Presbyterian Church of Scotland gospel, amongst the Highlanders. And of course, Outlander fans will probably have an inkling as to know why this would be the case, because of course they would want to lure the Highlanders away from the Catholic religion or the Episcopalian practices that had drawn many of the Highlanders towards the Jacobite cause. So this sort of printing of Bibles in the Gaelic language en masse was part of a plan to try and boost the Church of Scotland's presence and Presbyterian presence in the Scottish Highlands to lure the Highlanders away from Catholic and Episcopalian practices and views that obviously had fueled Jacobite rebellions. Smellie's Gaelic New Testament was published in 1767. Also, part of Jamie's sort of stock that he would have sold would have been cheap print, and these were known as chapbooks. And these are the more popular end of the market, and they're sort of short books from 8 to 24 pages long, and they covered a vast array of subjects: comedy, romance, fairy tales, history, ballads, poems and songs. And some of them could be very serious, some of them could be humorous, and some of them could be downright rude. They're quite an array of different publications.
So why would Jamie becoming a printer under an assumed name be politically significant and clever move?
Under an assumed name of sorts, which he sort of is, but he's using his middle names, obviously. It's still a massive risk if he was found out to be a former Jacobite. He would be tarred with that brush, still, even 20 years later. So he's still got to hide his past, if you like. However, becoming a printer was a very, very clever move. This is because becoming a printer means a whole change in his identity and his outlook. Most works that he will be publishing will be printed in English. So from a language perspective, he looks very much like a Lowland Scot. So either works will be printed in English or Lowland Scots. So from a language perspective, he looks like a Lowland Scot. Nobody, obviously with the name Alexander Malcolm, he would get away with it because Malcolm, as a last name, you know, looks very much like a Lowland name. So it's all part of the game, if you like, to create a new identity. Also, by registering his name, which he would have done with the legal authorities, with licensing, etc., using the name Alexander Malcolm, he would have assumed a new legal identity in Scots law. So he's created a new whole identity for himself that he's enshrined in law, because he will have had to have registered himself with the authorities to print works. Also, as well, being part of the Enlightenment, he's moved away from the Jacobite cause. I'm sorry to shatter this for Outlander fans, but Jamie, being a printer, is no longer, from a surface point of view anyway, a Jacobite. He's moved away from the Jacobite cause and he's embracing Hanoverian values of progress and discoveries, which later leads to Britain's Industrial Revolution. And this is a whole, the Enlightenment is, Scottish Enlightenment is part of this process. So in a sense, being part of the Enlightenment, printing Enlightenment works, being in Edinburgh, he is embracing Hanoverian values of progress and discovery and science. Which historians looking back, and I know it's very, very simplistic, state that this trajectory of history stands in complete opposition to the Jacobite movement. So I'm sorry to say to Outlander fans, in effect, by taking on this new identity, Jamie has become at least a loyal subject of the Hanoverian state. And that's what is the image he's wanting to project. So it's a whole new identity. It's a whole change in his identity, his persona.
What kind of life would Jamie have had as a printer in Edinburgh compared to, say, when he was laird at Lallybroch?
Jamie's life in Edinburgh would have stood in stark contrast to his life as laird of Lallybroch. In some respects, he slid down the social ladder. I'm afraid to say he is no longer a landowner, but performs a trade. A very respectable trade, I have to say, but it's a trade nonetheless. So he slid down the social ladder, he was a landowner, and now he forms a trade. In order to do this trade, he would have had to obtain and complete an apprenticeship before owning his own business. And even when he owns his own business, and we think of business owners as in today's world, people who do climb the social ladder. But back in the 18th century, because he's no longer a landowner and he's performing a trade, he has slipped down the social ladder despite having his own business. In 1776, Edinburgh was a large stinking pit. I'm not gonna mince my words with this at all. It was a large stinking pit, and it's I'm just going to be completely honest. Jamie had already visited Edinburgh as part of the Jacobite army, so he would have known what to expect. However, visiting Edinburgh with an army and living there would be two different things. In contrast to the wide open spaces and greenery of the Highlands, Edinburgh was highly cramped, stinking and filthy. Many of its inhabitants lived in what we call closes. Now, closes were tightly packed tenement housing with narrow rows and underground streets, where disease and death were present on a constant basis. If any of you have been to Edinburgh, you might have gone to St Mary's Close, which is one of the closes that visitors can visit. It's an underground close where you can go under. And actually, you can go there and you can see what sort of, you know, where people in Edinburgh back in the 18th century, how they would have lived. And it really is filthy, cramped housing where dysentery and plague have struck these areas with particular aggression. In the year after 1776, in 1767, plans for the new town of Edinburgh to rebuild the housing and to construct wide open spaces were in their infancy. So again, to emphasise that we're not quite at a stage yet where Edinburgh is building its new town, which is obviously characterised by lovely Georgian squares, lovely beautiful houses, lovely wide open spaces. In 1767, the year after Claire meets Jamie, plans are just beginning for the new town of Edinburgh, so it's still a sort of filthy, stinking hole. In that sense, plans are in their infancy. However, they had thought about improving Edinburgh even by this stage. So there's where Princes Street Gardens is now, if you go back to Edinburgh and you go to Princes Street, if you look across at the big green area, it's a square area, it's Princes Street Gardens, that used to be a loch called the Norloch. And it used to be obviously a loch, it was filled with water. Part of it had been drained by 1752, so they had made some improvements. But the eastern end of the Norloch wasn't drained. The eastern end of the Norloch was drained in 1763. And so they had already made improvements by 1766. And it's because waterborne diseases were commonplace with the Norloch. So they had started to make improvements with this. But we're still a long way off. Edinburgh is still very, very cramped, still very, very filthy. Sewage and waste flowed down the streets of the old town as the natural shape of the city and the sharp descent of the streets could act as a natural sewage drainage system. So when Claire's walking up the streets, there'll be sewage running the other way. Horrible thought, but true. So in short, it was incredibly smelly, and hence the need for the new town, because you've now got affluent businessmen who want to have nice houses, who want to live in green open spaces. So hence why in 1767, plans are submitted for the new town.
Could you describe the contents of a typical 18th century print shop in Edinburgh?
The historian John Morris states that 18th century print shops were modest affairs and were highly efficient. A typical print shop in Edinburgh would be on two or three floors. On the ground floor is where books were sold. On the first floor would be the printing press. Now in the 18th century, printing presses were built on wooden frames, in contrast to the later iron printing presses of the 18th century, the 19th century, that we're all familiar with. So the 18th century presses were wooden framed, so they could be kept on the first floor, which meant the ground floor would be a shop. Also, Edinburgh print shops, in contrast to the London counterparts, had large windows on the first floor, and I think you see that in the print shop scene. I haven't seen it yet because we don't get it in the UK till tonight, but from what I've seen with snippets, this is exactly how it is in the scene. So where the printing press is, there's a large window on the first floor that allows the light through so that the compositors can see where they're putting the type, putting the letters before printing. There was also a third floor in some printing houses, which could be a warehouse to keep newly printed books before selling, or blank paper for the presses. It would take two men to operate an 18th century printing press, so Jamie would not have worked on his own. He will have needed somebody else to operate the printing press. One person would spread ink on the type, The other would lay the paper and pull the bar, releasing the plate with the inky type, which made the impression on the paper. Once the bar had swung back, the paper and the newly printed material was removed from the machine and was hung up for drying. Most printers had three types of font: English and Roman for numerals and Latin, and italic. However, printers in Edinburgh, particularly those printing intellectual pieces during the Enlightenment, had a greater variety of fonts, including Pica, Saxon, Greek, Hebrew, Arabic, Teutonic, and mathematical fonts. And the Fleming printers in Edinburgh, which would have been around at the time Jamie was around, owned whole cases of all these different types and fonts in the 18th century, and which I find fascinating. You've got all these different sort of fonts and languages, etc., being printed in Edinburgh due to the Enlightenment.
Going back to the spread of the ideas, how does print and books sit alongside the Highlands and Jacobite clans?
The Highlands, for the most part, lay outside this information revolution for some considerable time. Inverness did not obtain a printing press until 1774, and this was alongside Crieff in Perthshire, which is also in the Highlands, in the Perthshire Highlands. There were some presses established before this date in the territories of the Campbell clan Argyll, but as I said before, the Campbell clan are very loyal to the government. But these presses are only temporary. The presses in the sort of areas of the Campbell clan are cottage industries set up by journeymen. As the term suggests, they're travelling printers and don't last. There are key reasons as to why the Highlands, for the most part, lie outside this sort of information revolution that is taking place throughout the rest of Scotland. Firstly, the majority of pamphlets were written in English, and although the clan chiefs and the taxmen, or the money collectors on behalf of the clan chiefs, became more anglicised, the majority of the people in the Highlands understood Gaelic rather than English. Gaelic still predominates. And so when you've got a printing press that is geared towards the English language rather than Gaelic, there's obviously the majority of the population in the Highlands is not going to be catered for. Secondly as well, Gaelic oral culture was still important in the 18th century, and therefore the written word was not so important. So although clans did write things down, in their histories, in the Gaelic culture, passing on information was predominantly by word of mouth. It wasn't in written form. So again, this still predominated by the 18th century, particularly amongst the sort of more lowly Highlanders. So in short, the demand in the market for books in the Highlands was too small to make a profit. But also, of course, you've got the difficulty of transporting books. And although Wade had designed a road system and was making headway back in the 1720s, it still was a very, very difficult place to transport books, etc., and sell books. So the market for books in the Highlands was too small to make a profit. Gaelic books were published in the Lowlands, and they had been published in the Lowlands since the 17th century. But it was always a very niche and specialised market. Very, very small number of Gaelic books compared to the number of Scots or Lowland Scots books and English books being churned out by the printing presses. So linguistically, Gaelic is very much in the minority as far as the printing presses are concerned. The government was probably reluctant to give Inverness a licence until 1774. It is noteworthy that the first book to come from the press, from this particular press, was the Psalms in Gaelic. By now, the Jacobite threat had long subsided and the Gaelic language was no longer seen as potentially subversive, and this is very important. For a long time after the Jacobite rebellions, the Gaelic language was tainted with some form of political subversion. They might have written books about fairy tales, they might have written books about prayers in them, but as far as the English government was concerned, or the British government was concerned, because they don't understand Gaelic, they have no interest in understanding Gaelic, they see Gaelic, and for a long time it was tainted with subversion. So therefore, the Inverness probably doesn't get a press until 1774, because by this time the Jacobite threat, it has subsided and Gaelic is no longer seen as potentially subversive. In addition, the Presses Foundation, particularly in Inverness, coincided with a renewed vigour to spread the Presbyterian gospel to the superstitious Highlanders, who still held strange pagan folk beliefs and customs, to outsiders anyway, in that sense. To outsiders, a lot of the folk beliefs and the customs that the Highlanders had, like the second sight, etc., were seen as superstitious and non-Christian. So the Church of Scotland went on a sort of pilgrimage to try and bring the Presbyterian gospel to Highlanders, to get rid of these customs and beliefs. And also, again, as I say, to pull them away from the Catholic faith and the Protestant Episcopal faith that had drawn many Highlanders to the Jacobite cause. It goes without saying that for a long time after the 45, printing anything remotely Jacobite related would have been banned and seen as subversive and treasonous. With government oversight of the presses and censorship, it would have been an illegal move. In Jamie's case, it would have been a highly suicidal move to make. Hence why the Jacobites relied heavily on emblems and material objects, particularly in Britain, such as engraved glasses and lockets of hair, and easily concealed miniatures to display their continued loyalty. Although, having said that, after 1745, the manufacture and distribution of these sort of emblems and material objects goes in sharp decline and withers as the cause withers away itself.
Fascinating. Are there any online resources that Outlander fans can consult if they wish to know more about printing in the 18th century?
There are certainly online resources that Outlander fans can consult on print culture in the 18th century. There's probably there's links to, I will put up post links from the National Library of Scotland, and I will post links from the University of Aberdeen, which have major collections on print culture in 18th century Scotland, which perhaps Outlander fans will find interesting.
Excellent. Thank you, Christine, so much. We love having you back. And we're always up for another chat about 18th century Scotland. We would love to have you back because we know we find it interesting and we are positive that our listeners will find it interesting as well. So thank you so much for joining us again.
Well, thank you so much for the invitation. It's very kind of you, and I've enjoyed being back. Absolutely. So thank you very much.
And have a great rest of your
afternoon.
Thank you.
Well, thank you again. Thank you very much for the opportunity. It was a pleasure. Thank you.
So thank you, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at outlanderpod.